it's been just the most wonderfully social engagement, and so good for us. We get to play our music regularly, and for an audience who are in a great mood and, you know, are ready to talk about the things they hear. I recommend it to any group, anybody who can find a space where they could have like a regular, an easygoing evening appearance. I know the Beatles did it back in the day, right? They had a regular club spot in Berlin for, I think, a couple of years.
Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman, which I hope inspires you through the personal stories of a diversity of musicians with in-depth conversations and great music that reveal the depth and breadth to a life in music. Charleston composer Dorothy Lawson is one of the founding members and artistic directors for Ethel, a string quartet celebrating 25 years of setting the standard for contemporary concert music. In this episode, you'll hear about many fascinating and meaningful collaborations with musicians including Alison Loggins-Hull, Robert Mirabal, and Laila Chakesh. It was really inspiring to hear how they got started with adapting the concert experience into something less predictable, ways to connect with new audiences. Dorothy also shared her insights into playing and teaching the cello and staying healthy. We also talked about many of the long-term relationships with the Metropolitan Museum, Denison College, and the Grand Canyon Music Festival's Native American Composer Apprentice Project. You'll be hearing excerpts from three of Ethel's recent albums, and everything is linked to their website in the show notes. This is my final podcast for this year, episode 51 of season 4, and season 5 starts in a couple of weeks in January. Please check the links for different ways to support and follow this independent podcast. I really do need the help of my listeners. I do all the many jobs of research, production, and publicity. The podcast theme music was commissioned from composer Nick Cold, and you can use the timestamps to navigate the episode. Now to Dorothy Lawson. Hi, Dorothy. Thanks so much for joining me here today.
Oh, Leah, it's a pleasure. It really is. And so nice to connect with you in Ottawa.
Well, just before we started recording, I was remarking that my husband actually knew you way back from your Toronto days, but you've been in New York for many years.
Yes. I've lived in New York for I think it's almost 40 years now. And so it's way more than half my life. But you know, Toronto was a huge experience, a very strong imprint. I like to feel that I've carried some of that culture forward to infect some of New York with some of that nature. New York is a fabulous creative environment, but Canada has a sense of support for the arts, which is sorely missing in a lot of the United States, you know? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you founded the Quartet Ethel many years ago. So, and you're artistic director as well as the cellist with the group.
I'm one of the two founding, remaining founding members, and one of the two co-artistic directors. Yes, exactly.
Okay. Yeah, with the violist, right?
Yes, exactly. Ralph Ferris, yeah.
Okay. So you and Ralph got this started, and I was just fascinating researching this wonderful ensemble and all the different projects. So we're going to touch on a few projects, but one of your recent recordings that's been released is Persist with some emerging composers. And I was really interested to hear some of these works.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear.
Do you want to talk about how that got started?
Yeah, sure. I'd love to. Ethel even when we began, we knew that we wanted to focus on contemporary music. The idea was to give, to champion music by contemporary composers, by people we knew, people who were not yet famous or, you know, well-recognized or who could use the high quality delivery. And it was an identity that we really enjoyed. And it has always been that way. This project generates from that because we began a commissioning, an iterative commissioning project many, many years ago. About every 3-4 years, we would do a round where we raised the money, approached or put out a commissioning call, and chose composers we thought were exciting and appropriate. And really, one of our background criteria is always just, is this music we want to play ourselves? You know, it's not a value judgment on the composers per se. It's actually more just how do we acquire more music that will look good on us, you know, and we want to do a good job for them. So this round, this was part of that project. We call it Home Baked. And this round, we reached out to Allison Loggins Hull, who is a very rising star, very, very well known now. Although when this began, which was under the pandemic, so it's been a few years already, you know, she was just reaching sort of another stage of her career. And was taken on by the Cleveland Orchestra as one of their composition fellows. We've known her for more than 10 years. Actually, we had even worked with her, not as performers, but as she worked for our foundation. And we always liked her. We always thought she was a terrific talent, and that we were able to kind of catch the rising star and commission a piece for her own instrument, the flute, with the quartet, and then expand on it with this larger project to bring in a number of other composers we did not know for flute and quartet, which has produced this group of pieces which we, you know, which we group underneath Allison's title, Persist. So it's very demonstrative of a kind of an internal culture, the culture of Ethel, the way that we think of ourselves as kind of mediums between composers and the audience, between cultures. Between the old and the new, I mean, you know, we enjoy that. We enjoy being a kind of a bridge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it might be interesting, even before we get more into that album, for people that don't know your music, that you really have a lot of improvisation and you've played, you know, across many genres. You've toured with rock musicians, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sort of the moment when Ethel started, which is just around the millennium, just a little before the millennium, was an interesting crisis point in the American music scene, maybe even wider than that. But the traditional concert models were starting to kind of break apart. You know, the audiences were not showing up anymore in as you know, as fully or as regularly. And it was an interesting moment. It's just like there was a rising wave of a new attitude, a new approach. And we were among the early adapters, you know, the people who sort of enjoyed it. We were creatures of a next culture, and we were all well enough established as professionals in New York that we could live on our own productivity, on our own incomes, without having to make a lot of money at doing this right away. So it gave us some time to develop the relationships, to develop the new repertoire, to explore possibilities. And this, you know, as I was saying, this sort of curiosity about what would be interesting and viable to this new audience that was emerging, because people just weren't responding as happily to the classical model, the sort of more time-honored, well-respected, but more predictable forms of musical concert music experience. And the New York environment just was so busy with commercial projects and movies and visiting artists. And yes, we got to play lots of classical music as well, but you know, in regional orchestras, or, you know, I even did a few, you know, freelance dates with the New York Philharmonic, you know, I mean, lots of other experience. And it was just the joy of meeting these kindred spirits who all embraced this idea that if we enjoyed it, literally the Ellington credo, you know, if it sounds good, it is good, you know, and we felt very strongly that it gave us the artistic license, you know, to just do music that we personally respond to. And we continue to look very carefully at the audience, very carefully at the environment, and say, is this still viable? Is this still the necessary? Are we still, you know, supporting a kind of a culture that's growing here? Because things continue to evolve. Everything continues to change. I just say that New York was an essential element of getting us going, both because we all had the access to these wildly different experiences and different friendships, different connections. I mean, some of that rock tour that you talked about, the one big one was with Todd Rundgren and Joe Jackson, and that really came out of two friendships. One was with a presenter who was based in an alternative music space downtown New York next to the Public Theater, and a man called Bill Bragan. And he was curating this fascinating new set of performances, but also the free public concerts in Central Park in the summertime. Mm-hmm. So part of it was an invitation from him, and part of it was actually this pre-existing friendship between Joe Jackson and one of our original violinists, Mary Rowell, who had played on every one of Joe's albums for like a decade. So when we emerged with this quartet, Joe was very intrigued, and he thought, oh, that'd be great. Why don't I involve the quartet in my next album? You know, and so we did a recording with him. And when this opportunity through the Public Theater came up for a concert in Central Park with Todd Rundgren and Joe Jackson, Joe Jackson was actually the one who vouched for us. He said, oh, they're great. You know, don't worry. And Todd said, okay, fine. If Joe likes them, great, let's do it. So it's just funny how these things happen. I would say there's always a social element. There's always something about the relationships and the trust between people that plays a role in how things move.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really interesting. Well, let's get back into the Persist album.
Okay.
So I chose a few clips that I particularly appealed to me. I really liked Terraria by Sam Wu.
Yes. Yeah, yes, thank you. We too, yeah. He's a brilliant young man. I mean, I think he only finished his doctorate like this year or something. Anyway, he's already got a teaching position. He's written many pieces for major orchestras. He's extremely talented. When he showed up as part of our search, we were thinking, oh, this would be great. Let's just grab, you know, this guy before he gets too big. You know, and he wrote us this exquisite little. It's a kind of a meditation on microscopic gardens, you know, and there's you know, the hanging gardens and the bonsais, and you know, it's adorable. We really, really love it. Yeah, I hope these are pieces that we can contribute to the general repertoire. I mean, I really think other people will enjoy it.
You're about to hear a clip from Terraria by Sam Wu.
Yeah. Thanks for that. And of course, people can click on the link in the description of the podcast to go to the album. And I wanted to include a clip from We Began This Quilt by Anne Lanzelotti. Does she use her middle name?
I think she does say Lelehua Lanzelotti. That's right. That's her kind of her stage name. Yes. Yeah. Well, again, she's been a finalist for a Pulitzer. She's a brilliant, beautiful voice for the music of Hawaii, the culture of Hawaii, which is also why we chose her. We were very, in this particular set of commissions, we were very concerned to be very to bring as much diversity into the project as we could, and her voice is completely unique and beautiful. It's a very dreamy kind of patient piece, but it actually speaks about the imprisonment of the last queen of Hawaii, the last authentic queen of Hawaii, under the American government. She was imprisoned in her own home, in her own palace. And one of the backstories to the piece is that she was kept in contact with her people by these very quiet, very, very, very mild-mannered gifts that people would bring, mostly gifts of flowers or food or something, and they would leave them with the guards, but they were wrapped in newspapers. And the newspapers would carry the messages, or the information of the day. So there, you know, it's just... There's such an integrity to these cultures that you can't destroy just by overwhelming them with force.
This is an excerpt from We Began This Quilt There. And Reconciliation Suite by Migiwa Miyajima.
Yes. Migi Miyajima. Yeah. Well, she's a masterful composer. It's very good, mature writing. She's in her 40s, I think. But she's self-taught. She's a self-taught composer. She came to America from Japan because she was so urgent to learn jazz, to speak jazz, to make a career as a jazz musician. She leads her own big band. She's like I said, she's a masterful composer. The music is beautiful, original, fun, sweet. This was part of what thrilled us so much out of the group of pieces as they emerged, was each one of them were so loving and good-natured. You know, they're not a problematic set of pieces. it's quite wonderful, because we don't put any restrictions on our composers. We don't ask, except, I'm sorry, the definition is really just for the quartet, hopefully they'll look at what we are and, you know, what we sound like and work with that. But for us, and between 9 and 12 minutes long. That's kind of the definition of what we ask for.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good to have time restrictions, right?
Right. It turns out to be very, 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 you know, yeah, restriction isn't a bad thing. It, you know, kind of makes creativity more essential, yeah.
Although one of the composers I spoke to recently, he was saying that you'd be surprised that to write a miniature can take so much time, just like a great short story as opposed to a novel, because it has to be so perfect. And
very true. Very true. Yeah. Very true. Yeah, well, yes, we're aware of that. We're aware of that. It's not like we think, oh, this is just a light thing. That is literally the shape of the music that we perform most of the time. We don't mm-hmm. do, in fact, I don't think at the moment, Miyajima, maybe the only one who gave us a multi-movement piece that we will use. You know, it's like it's very little of our repertoire at the moment is in more than one movement. Mm-hmm.
This is a clip from the first movement of Reconciliation Suite by Migiwa Migi Miyajima.
And of course, we must include a clip from Persist, Allison's piece.
What? Please, yeah. Well, she you know, she speaks about it extremely elegantly. It is autobiographical towards her family. You know, it's her family's journey in enslavement across the Atlantic to the Caribbean, it's got this patient. It is persistent. It's very patient. It has a kind of a slow but irresistible sense right from the beginning of just in a way almost inscrutable patience. Just that, you know, this is going to happen. It's going to keep happening. You know, these rhythms that continue. There is quite an episode where you really hear oars dropping into the ocean. You know, in fact, even she uses electronics. So in the very, very beginning, there are plopping sounds that really evoke, you know, oars in water. And she takes it on a journey. You know, it goes towards kind of anger and frenzy and some amount of you know, distress, but then it resolves again into this long, long patience. And it's extremely, it's just very listenable. You know, it tells the story. It tells it beautifully. There are sweet moments. There are very, very high tension moments. You know, the overall, I think she created a musical experience that really ties it up, really brings it back to sort of the way that this just becomes part of your nature. You know, it's like part of your cultural identity.
This is an excerpt from the beginning of Persist by Allison Loggins Hull.
I was thinking about how just the emergence of iPads on stage must have been such an incredible help to your quartet, because you use kind of minimalist small iPads, I noticed, and you often perform from memory as well, depending on the repertoire, right?
Yeah, that's right. Well, so I think we started using the iPads back in 2008 or 9, you know, when we were building a show that required projections, big projections. And it was just so clear that, as you're saying, the smaller piece of technology, rather than the big old metal stands with the paper, the small pad on a single foot, the microphone stand, was much less distracting, much less intrusive in front of us and in front of the projections. Of course, over the years, we've recognized what a facilitation it is to be able to carry around literally our entire repertoire in one piece of equipment. You know, and it never gets any heavier. You can load it with all the different, you know, scores that you want, but it's just what it is. And we've had a few technical challenges with it over the years, like that very first show was our Documerica show at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. You know, I was a complete novice to the iPad. During the opening night of a three-night run, during the premiere performance, I had not realized that because I had my Wi-Fi opened, my various accounts associated with my online identities were available. And in the middle of the show, in fact, in the middle of the most difficult piece on the program, I received a FaceTime call and my music disappeared. It just evaporated. It was like watching something physical evaporate, you know, and I was shocked. I was, what? Fortunately, the actual request also had a red button on it saying decline. So I quickly reached for it and declined it. I didn't even know what would happen, but fortunately it reverted to my music, which was a huge relief, but I had no idea that could happen. So yes, iPads are fun, but they're a bit of a learning curve as well. Yeah. It's yeah.
Yeah. I saw some clips. Actually, I think you have an online, there's a YouTube of your circus performance, which is a very interesting project. So I wanted to ask you about that, how it came about.
Thank you. Well, so having the Documerica show was the first one where we had invited a video designer to work with us, sampling materials from an online database, from the Environmental Protection Agency, which they called Documerica, which was generated back in the 70s. And we weren't even really sure if it was going to be relevant enough, but it was so inspiring. The composers responded to it beautifully. The video designer came up with just a fabulous show. And actually, it was a partnership between a video designer and a theater director. And they just designed an amazing experience, which we wrote, and the composers we engaged all wrote original music for. So we traveled with that. We've been traveling, and we still do occasionally perform this show for many, many years. And we took it at one point to Sarasota, Florida, to the Ringling Museum, and performed it there, and they loved it. And they realized quite quickly, you know, just immediately, they realized they have a visual archive as well. They have a huge collection of circus memorabilia and images from a century worth or 150 years worth of photography and old movies and fan-generated, you know, documents that have been sent to them over and over the years. And they just asked us, they said, hey, would you work with our collection on a show like this? And we said, of course, we'd love to. Oh my gosh. You know, what a treat. So that project, I think it took us about 4 years to get from that point, from the point of, you know, getting the idea and creating the relationship to being on stage, performing it live, and the video, the YouTube that's online came from, I think it was the final dress rehearsal for the show at the theater, at the Ringling Museum Theater. It's one of our, you know, deepest, most heartfelt relationships. We love the people there. We love that museum. And part of the joy in that show was drawing from their collection. They have a body of interviews, of video interviews that they've collected with the retired circus stars who live in Sarasota. And they tell phenomenal stories about their lives, about the adventures, the experience of living with circus, being in circus. And it's so interesting. Anyway, yeah, it was a beautiful experience, very inspiring, and we learned so much.
Mm-hmm. And you learned so much about the world of circus, or just how to put together a show like that?
Both. Well, in the case of that show, the earlier show was really visuals married to sound. It was very a concert with an integral visual experience. The Documerica show, exactly. The circus, the full title was Circus Wandering City, and that was more theatrical. That was actually fully staged. We worked with a very brilliant young director, a man called Grant McDonald, and we pulled together an entire team, sound, lighting, costume, and set design. We actually also did a certain amount of circus training ourselves, because we wanted to evoke it without getting, you know, without somehow projecting that we were actors. We're not actors. We can't, you know, we're not going to pretend we're doing that. But my colleagues, Kip Jones and Corin Lee, the two violinists, wanted very, very much to have a fencing moment with their bows. So we got some fencing training. We actually, you know, engaged a trainer and got them their skill set. And you know, again, the part of the director's job in that show was to make sure that we stayed on the right side of making these gestures, you know, like not doing things that we would look really, really fake at, you know, just things that were funny and credible enough to make a good moment on stage. Yeah.
Okay.
Hi, just a quick break from the episode. You may be also interested in my episodes with the Euclid Quartet, the Chang Square Duo, Martha Mook, Meg Okura, Rebecca Omordia, Pat Irwin, and so many more, all linked in the show notes. It's a joy to be able to bring these meaningful conversations to you, but this project cost me quite a bit of money and lots of time. Please support the series through either my merchandise store or on my Ko-fi page. You'll find the links in the show notes. For the merch, it features a unique design by artist Steffi Kelly, and you can browse clothes, phone cases, notebooks, and more, everything printed on demand. You'll also find the links to sign up for my newsletter, where you'll get access to exclusive information about upcoming guests. Please check out my back catalog with weekly episodes going back to 2021. Now back to Dorothy Lawson.
Now, the name of your group originally was Hazardous Materials, right?
That existed for about 5 months, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, we realized, you know, because back in 2000, you know, 1998, you know, when we started, we tried Hazardous Materials. We were experimenting with, you know, philosophical names and poetic names, and we thought, okay, that's kind of representative. We're breaking the mold. We want to no, we want people to know that we're not doing the classical, you know, the regime. But we also realized we want to have fun. We wanted to have a good time. We also didn't want the audience walking in expecting everything to sound edgy and dangerous, you know. So we left that behind very quickly. And the way we got Ethel, which I really do enjoy, was if you can, you know, people will remember the movie Shakespeare in Love. It had appeared in 19, I think it was released in 1997. So we came along very shortly after that. And as we were kind of, you know, fussing around with names, one of the original violinists, Mary Rowell, came, who has, she's just this fabulous Vermont type, Vermont farm girl, very wry sense of humor, a brilliant violinist, an incredible jazz player, blues, you know, we were talking about improvising. Yeah, improvising has been part of our necessary skill set right from the beginning. She came into one of our rehearsals laughing because she had been thinking about the movie Shakespeare in Love, and she was saying, you know, it just hits me. In Shakespeare in Love, there's this fundamental joke. The first thing, almost the first thing you hear, Shakespeare's boss at the Globe Theater is challenging him to write the next big hit. He's going to write, he's going to bring the entire village into the theater, and it's going to be a comedy. It's going to be so funny, nobody can resist it. And it's going to be called Romeo and Ethel the Pirate's Daughter. So we realized that that joke really hinges on the idea that you're expecting Juliet and Ethel the Pirate's Daughter walks into the room. And we realized, you know, that's really us as a string quartet. We're not Juliet. We're Ethel the Pirate's Daughter. So that was the fun moment. We got our own permission out of choosing something that was really just deflecting the entire serious legacy of string quartet.
Yeah. And let's face it, band names are hard, right?
Yes. You may have heard a lot about that. It's true. Yeah. Well, and it's, that's one of those crazy things about being in a group for 26 years is realizing what the long outcomes of some of these choices are. And going, yeah, we chose that out of a certain spirit, you know, joie de vivre, a certain spirit of the moment. But it created a long, an interesting long struggle in just explaining what the heck we're doing. It's fascinating.
Yeah. I interviewed Pat Irwin, who's a composer and band guy. Yeah, he's been on this podcast twice. And so his band Sus, I asked him why it was capitalized, if it was an acronym. He said, no, it's just cooler that way. So I think Ethel's...
Yes, well, and the only reason we capitalize Ethel is because otherwise we thought very early on people would expect a woman called Ethel to walk onto the stage, and we're saying, no, there's nobody called Ethel. You know, so yeah, Pat's awesome. I love Pat. Yeah, okay.
So you've had some changes in personnel, which is normal for such a long-lived group. So I'm curious in terms of the audition process or finding the right fit, because you need these improvisatory skills and this kind of showmanship.
Well, you can also imagine that every audition is just what happens in its own time. You know, you don't have the same body of talent available. You don't have the same, you know, you're trying to get the word out, but you're also trying to inform yourself who's there, who's available now, you know. And we've really evolved, I guess, large scale twice. So this is our third iteration for a long term, and this is actually the longest lived of our groups. This foursome is now about 10 years old. And I think it's got a new maturity to it, which is very, very lovely and exciting. And we're all from different generations. You know, I mean, the violinist I was referring to before, Mary and I are exactly the same age. So we've always been kind of the oldest people of the group. And then now Ralph, my founding colleague, is the next generation. But we're several years apart. I think we're like 12 years apart. And then Kip Jones is in his 40s, and Corin Lee is in his very, very early 30s. So we have very, very different perspectives on and skill sets and a history, an identity of doing things that stray across genres and across cultures, and we look for auditions. We look for colleagues, new colleagues who are interested in that, you know, and who have maybe some skills to add to that mix, along with a high, very high level of classical training. We still need that classical core. And that's part of what we offer to our collaborators. And we've looked for collaborations across any kind of cultural, you know, perspective. And but we feel like one of the values that we offer to our collaborators is this very, recognized and accepted level of classical skill, which, you know, brings us into a certain relationship with our audience. And then when we are doing one of these collaborations where we're working with somebody whose life and art form are substantially different, there's a blend, there's a way of speaking to each other in the music that our audience will still hear, will still you know, recognize. And we hope, anyway, our intention is that this opens the mind and the heart to a deeper kind of sharing, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, maybe we could talk about, you've had many, many years of collaboration with Robert Mirabal.
Yes, thank you. Have you ever interviewed him?
No, I've not. Maybe we could include a clip from the Red Willow Suite people to that project.
Beautiful. Love that. Yeah, please.
So yes. You've done residencies in Taos. Do you want to talk about that project a little bit?
Let's see. We reached out to Robert. Oh, man. I was like, may I give you a rather longer view of how that worked?
Sure.
We were engaged, again, out of New York, out of the friendships, out of just all the different relationships that we had. When we were only 5 years old, I guess we were just reaching seven. We were just reaching 7 years old. We were invited by the directors of the Grand Canyon Music Festival to work for them at the end of the summer in their festival. They had designed a program to reach out to the natural Native American communities right around the Grand Canyon, notably the Navajo Nation, Hopi Nation, and Pima Nations, engaging a composer with a Western European training and the ability to compose and notate music in our style, but then also a performing group like ours, like a string quartet, from that tradition, from the Western European tradition. And they had been running this program for, I think, 5 years at that point, and they reached out to me, to us, to the quartet. They're very, very old friends of mine, and said, would you like to do this with us? Would you like to come out and experience this great project we've got with Native American composers apprentices? These were high school students all around Navajo Nation. I think it's still going. This is a project that, you know, began back in 2000. It was initiated at the millennium, It was a millennially. There was funding available at that moment for cultural, you know, cultural projects of cultural advancement. Also, projects for the national parks, and so they won one of these grants, and they engaged the Native American composer Brent Michael Davids to help them design this program. So we were one of those first groups who got to travel there, and we did that work every year. At the end of the summer, we would go there for 10 years, for a decade. And we were working, you know, with these kids who had always written music for themselves. It's just part of the culture. Music is an applied skill. It's something you do. In fact, it's almost kind of an insanity to imagine you would pay somebody to do it. It's, you know, they wouldn't even think that way. It's we all make music. It's just what we do. So these kids had deep understanding and experience with music. They had no difficulty creating music, but they had never used our technology of writing it down. And what we came to realize was the music they wrote was perfect without any discussion, without any intercession on our parts. We were not teaching them how to write music. We were just giving them advice on how to communicate it through the notation. And on the other hand, as a kind of a biofeedback, we were playing their music and they were telling us what they needed to hear. So we had to realize what an incredibly big and heavy bag of baggage that, you know, the all the stuff that we had learned in our culture that we were dragging around as if this would apply everywhere. And we were told very clearly, no, don't do that. Don't make it louder. Don't make it faster. Don't, you know, we don't need it to be more exciting. We need it to be more patient, more beautiful. You know, oh, gotcha. Yes, please. Thank you. So we saw so much about ourselves in that. And we learned so much about the respect and nature of music in these cultures. So after doing that work, after doing that for several years, we proposed to the Brooklyn Academy that we do a show for them. Like they wanted something that was quasi-theatrical, but so we proposed that we would invite four master musicians of as many different cultures as we could find to work with us in talking to each other with our music and just figure out ways to collaborate, ways to speak and make music together. So we reached out. The Brooklyn Academy loved the idea. They accepted it and funded it. And we began the process of reaching out to these master musicians who had never heard of us and never remotely imagined they would ever get an invitation from a string quartet in New York City to do a musical event together, let alone with each other. You know, so we approached it very carefully. We knew that we'd have to win their trust. We, you know, because walking into any of these settings with a string quartet had such an immediate impact, such a set of assumptions that we would be coming to teach them something. There'd be some amount of condescension, you know, going on. And we were very, very careful to meet these artists in their communities, on their ground, and show them that we were very, very interested in their culture. And we would go to, we traveled to them, we stayed with them, we would go to their community concerts, their celebrations, and one of those four musicians we reached out to and who was immediately interested was Robert Mirabal, who is a Taos Pueblo native flute player. He is an elder in his community. He is a he's also a dancer, a singer, a poet, a movie star. he has lived all over the world. He's traveled through Russia. He's lived in Japan. He's, you know, he's traveled all over South America. He's and in a lot of ways, he showed us how to do it. So Robert became just an ongoing collaborator, somebody that we worked with now. I think we've created now 4 more shows with him. And we learn every time. He continues to teach us. But he also, he honors us deeply. He speaks about us as family. He depends on us when it comes to musical projects where he has to, because he's been engaged now to do movie scores and compose pieces for orchestra. So he does come and sort of say, okay, that's your skill set. How do I work with this? You know, we work with each other in many different ways. It's so rewarding. We love him. We love working with him. We love his family. He has 3 beautiful daughters who have all grown up since we've known him. And we're just family and friends. And the music, I would be delighted to share any of the Red Willow project, because that has the latest imprimatur of what we're doing. And it's become even more developed, even deeper. We tell stories about his culture, and we draw on his tribal music, it's unusual actually that he's been that willing to share it with us, and it's out of this trust. And he also feels that when we perform together, he appears as a kind of an emissary of a world that's disappearing, and a world of an ancient sets of awareness that our culture misses and needs, and it's his opportunity to communicate to some extent. You know, it's really. Those events are more like ceremonies than they are like concerts.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Thanks for that.
Yeah. Thank you for listening. Thank you for giving me the chance to talk about it. Yeah.
This is an excerpt from the trailer for the Red Willow Project with Robert Mirabal and Ethel.
Hundred and 10 years ago, it was a few days before San Geronimo feast day or harvest days. I remember this white man that came up to the village. He wasn't too tall and he wasn't too big. He said his name was Thurlow Lawrence. We call him Lolo because he was small. And he told me, I want to know about your songs. I want to know about your drums. I want to know about your flutes, and I want to know about the melodies. So we invited him into our home.
And you have another new album coming out. Your album Vigil with the Lebanese violinist composer.
I believe she says Layal Shakesh. I don't know. I do not know why the R becomes an sh sound, but yes, apparently that's how she says it. Yeah. She is glorious. She's a phenomenally beautiful person, beautiful woman, beautiful soul. She's generous and sweet and patient, and that she has engaged with this poetry, this devastating poetry, Vigil, to create a set of pieces, a set of movements that are hugely. Hugely dramatic, but also wailing and emotional, and I don't know what to. It's gorgeous. She plays. You know, she's also the composer performer on the record. She plays mostly with a very specific Lebanese original style, authentic violin style. But she is also trained as a Western violinist. In she graduated the London Guildhall, I think. She's married, lives in New Jersey, I think now, or Brooklyn. Maybe it's Brooklyn. Very close to New York. So we're now very deep friends. We were introduced by Ethel's manager, who was just listening to an NPR broadcast one day and heard her being interviewed. And she was talking about this project that she planned to write about the poetry. And she needed a string quartet. And he sort of asked us, do you think you'd be interested in that? And we said, of course. So he reached out, he proposed it. She was thrilled. And now, of course, you know, we've become very, very deep friends. The music is just glorious and very moving, very beautiful, but also very heartrending. She lives as a sort of not a refugee, but a, you know, an expat from Lebanon. She can't go home. Travel is impossible right now. Her family can't leave. You know, there's such interesting patience and courage among these you know, cultures that live with these deep, deep limitations and disruptions. You know, there's huge wisdom there. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is an excerpt from Vigil with Layal Shakesh. Thank you. Dorothy, I wanted to ask about your role as a teacher and mentor with your cello students, because you do teach cello.
Yes, I do. I love teaching.
Yeah. Is your approach different than your training, considering the type of career you've had?
You know, my approach is really to try to understand what the student wants to do with the instrument. You know, I even with, you know, with younger people, it's not usually so much of a question. They just want to be able to, you know, do what all their friends are doing, you know, and hopefully fit in with their school orchestra or something like that. You know, so I kind of know, I know a lot about what they need, you know, and I'm happy to work with them. I also have always had a number of adult students, and some of them want to play with a rock group, or they want to play folk melodies, or one of my longest and dearest friends is a cellist with whom I no longer give her lessons. We actually just get together and play duets or cello trios sometimes, if we're lucky, you know, and we've made all kinds of adaptations of music that we just want to be able to play, like, you know, great old songs like Cheek to Cheek and, you know, I Could Have Danced All Night. We have a lot of fun with it, you know. So I guess my own technique and my teaching method have changed very, very fundamentally from the way I was taught, because I've been blessed to have learned a lot more about the ergonomics of the instrument. And I've had training in Feldenkrais and you know, various kinds of body alignment, yoga. I've never had Alexander technique, although I know that's extremely influential. And just learned so much more about how the different muscle groups can impinge on each other, or how they, you know, support each other, how to draw energy from more of your body rather than being quite so limited and specific about, you know, the ways we're trained mostly to use very specific muscles in a very limited way. And the health of the whole system is not really addressed in a more traditional model. And a lot of us end up with trouble, you know, over the long run. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with you. And like you, I've explored many different mind-body things to help. And I think it's an ongoing journey, really.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And Well, these days, of course, I'm in my 60s, I'm in my high 60s, and I'm watching very carefully my diet, for example. I mean, that's less immediately effective on the instrument, but boy, does it affect your health. Boy, does it affect your energy and your sense of comfort. You know, it's phenomenal what how much that, you know, drives your well-being. Yeah.
Do you have strategies for staying healthy when you're touring?
Yeah, yes. I again, watching my diet is very, very, it's very difficult actually when you're on tour and you have less control. You have to deal with more immediate food sources. You don't always have a kitchen. You don't always have a local store with a good variety of, you know, food. And I do spend time, you know, sometimes I will try to carry certain foods around with me, you know, like foods that I think of as basic. I do yoga just for myself. I'll do an online class, you know, but I have a small routine that I do for myself, which just keeps the joints, you know, relaxed, open, the muscles reasonably, toned. I prefer not to expend a lot of energy doing other things while I'm on tour. You know, I know that when I was younger, I would love to go out and get to, you know, the local museums or the art galleries, or, you know, see the city, you know, get some experience. I don't do that so much anymore. I value a little bit more of the downtime, the chance to relax and you know, that get my energies to their peak at the moment when I have to be in the theater and ready for the show.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just saying, just for anybody who has to do it, please take air travel very, very seriously. It's very, very deleterious. It's very harmful to our health. And you do want to take remedies to, you know, if you've had to sit up for hours and hours and hours, you want to make up for that. You want to breathe more oxygen than usual because you've been in a diminished environment. You know, all kinds of side effects just to the travel, the impact of the travel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great advice. Well, I was curious in terms of engagement with different types of audiences. I know Ethel has this longstanding residency at the balcony bar of the Metropolitan Museum.
Yes.
And even during the pandemic, you had this whole virtual series from there.
Yes, yes. Oh, man, that has been just heaven sent. That's been a gift, you know, to have that position. The Metropolitan Museum has late opening hours on Friday and Saturday nights. Has done for years, 40 some odd years, I think. And they realized very early on that their audience, their public, wouldn't think of coming into a museum after dinner. It just wasn't normal, you know. So they incentivized it by making special things happen, you know, doing extra entertainment spaces and concerts, of course. Yeah, that's a natural. They have an auditorium. They've always had concerts there. But because they were expanding their hours, they opened what they call their balcony bar. It's in the Great Hall, which is the very, very first foyer you walk into. It's huge and glamorous, and over your head, over the main doors, is a balcony with their collection of Chinese porcelains, and it's lined with these tables, and we get to sit there and perform music on Friday and Saturday nights, and of course it's a little bit more like a cabaret. You still have the hubbub from the entranceway. You have people walking through. You have people having conversations and cheer and having glasses in their hands, you know, but everyone's in such a good mood. And we play our repertoire. We play Ethel music, and they love it. We've gained so many friends that way. We've got to meet people. We talk to them. We visit with them, and they learn more about our music. And we also curate. We program the other performers. We can't be there every week ourselves, so we have other performers, and we program that. They meet another audience. You know, it's been just the most wonderfully social engagement, and so good for us. We get to play our music regularly, and for an audience who are in a great mood and, you know, are ready to talk about the things they hear. I recommend it to any group, anybody who can find a space where they could have like a regular, an easygoing evening appearance. I know the Beatles did it back in the day, right? They had a regular club spot in Berlin for, I think, a couple of years. And it was essential to their skill set. You know, they really trained and rehearsed and became the well-formed group they were by the time they hit America. You know, they had lots of experience, and they had been able to explore their interest in American blues music, all kinds of stuff. You know, for us, that relationship is fundamental. We just love it. I will say it was because of we were championed there by the director of what they call live arts, being the performing arts at the Metropolitan Museum, a woman called Limor Tomer, who is also a very, very old friend of mine. And she came into the museum like 12 years ago in a moment where they wanted to make the collections at this very, you know, respected museum, make them more urgently available. Like, how do we get the audience to approach these these collections that have lived here for decades, how do we get them to approach them like something time-based, that you got to see it, you got to go, you got to be there, you know? And so her identity at the museum has been creating these much more time-based events in the galleries and in the, you know, in the Chinese court upstairs, in the Spanish courtyard, in the Greek and Roman collection, you know, and in the Temple of Dendur, the Egyptian collection, where people are now used to this idea that art can happen everywhere, immediately, at a given moment, you know, we are among the artists she brought in to do things that were much more time-based and relevant, not music that you could hear anywhere or you know, you might have heard for your whole life. This is now music that you will never hear anywhere else. And it's of its time and of its community and of its place. It was also her courage and her championship under the pandemic that kept this relationship going, because the museum closed for 2 years, and why would they continue, you know, an entertainment contract with people who couldn't even get into the museum? You know, instead, what they said was, we need to offer things to our community online. We'll have Ethel continue making these concert offerings. We'll release them at the same time as they would normally start playing on Friday night. And it became 2 years of activity that we would never have had otherwise, where we videoed and edited and you know, produced and released. It was over 100 concerts. And wow. They have acquired now, I think, more than 2 million views. So it was a huge opening for the Met, for us, for everybody. And we were able, because it was online, we were able to invite artists we had never met to participate. And we were able to release concert performances by Native Americans we'd never met, by artists in Asia, by artists in the Middle East, by artists in South America, in Mexico, you know. It was just brilliant. We kind of miss it.
And in terms of engaging with the public, you guys have that's the topic, but you have this residency at Denison University. It's a liberal arts college. So I was curious what kind of engagement you do with the students. Are there workshops? Are you coaching groups? How does that work?
Yes, of course. We do work with the music department. We do. That's a, you know, very natural, good connection, mm-hmm. easy to do. And we perform works by their composers, by their, you know, their student composers. We also coach and teach, just directly teach the musicians who are trying to do this kind of performance work. A big part of that relationship spins from the college's identity as a liberal arts, you know, mm-hmm. institution, where they propose and really demonstrate the value of bringing the arts and sciences closer and closer into communication. And they use us for that, largely. Mm-hmm. We will walk into classes in neuroscience and classes in chemistry and classes in philosophy, classes in, geoscience, you know, eco studies. The teachers, of course, are very interested. They're very aware. They are, they've framed it. They're ready, and the class has been sort of brought into an idea that this is a conversation. And sometimes we make music for them, or we make music with their ideas, with their study materials. Sometimes it's just an actual communication across, you know, experience, across wisdom, across, you know, what are our, you know, experiences or learnings in their various fields, and how do we relate to each other? It's wonderful. It's tremendous for us as people, as thinkers, as you know, citizens, citizens of the world. But it's also very, very clearly a step forward in the mission of the liberal arts. You know, getting these communities, even sometimes it's rarer, it's more difficult, but bringing the various departments into relationships with each other, and letting them build projects that relate. You know, we're busy building another program like that with the city university system in New York City. They have an honors program called Macaulay Honors College, and they are very. This is right up their designation. This is what they're trying to do. They're a kind of a leadership program. They're trying to get the students of every background. It's a public school, public college, and a lot of their students are maybe first generation college, or recent immigrants, or financially underserved, that we can provide some kind of deeper connection and enrichment is thrilling. It's just thrilling, so we're building it based on the Denison experience. We're building a new relationship with Macaulay, and we're very hopeful that this is something we could continue to travel with, and any university system that would like to consider something like that, because it's interesting how many different boxes it checks, we'd love to be available and more useful for people.
Wonderful. My impetus behind doing this podcast is really to show the world that there's such a breadth and depth to a life in music, and it can mean so many things. And Dorothy Lawson, Ethel String Quartet, just their beautiful example of all of that.
Thank you. Thank you, Leah Roseman. Really great to meet you. I'm thrilled we were able to have this conversation.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please share this with your friends and check out episodes you may have missed at leahroseman.com. If you could buy me a coffee to support this series, that would be wonderful. Or you can browse the collection of merch with a very cool, unique, and expressive design from artist Steffi Kelly, with notebooks, mugs, shirts, phone cases, and more. I'm an independent podcaster, and I really do need the help of my listeners. All the links are in the show notes. Have a wonderful week.